From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Memorial Day weekend usually marks the unofficial start of summer, which can mean gathering in large groups for just fun times, graduation, celebrations, maybe traveling. And for some reason, that usually leads to an increase in the summer crud, you know, those colds and viruses that seem to thrive in the warmer months. Dr. Dean Blumberg is the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Health and joins us today to break down the different bugs currently capturing the headlines and what you need to know to stay healthy and have a good time. Dr. Blumberg, welcome back.
Thank you.
So what are the most common cases you're seeing at the moment?
You know, right now we're seeing what we usually see this time of year, which is rhinoviruses. They are all year round. They circulate, and that's the common cold. And then we see enteroviruses, and one of the enteroviruses, some strains can cause the hand, foot, and mouth disease, mostly in children. Those start in the late spring and early summer. So we're certainly seeing that. And then we're also seeing some mycoplasma that can cause pneumonia, mostly in school-age children. But those are the main things we're seeing right now. And fortunately, COVID is circulating at a very low level right now.
Oh, that's good to hear. I mean, usually when the temperature's warm, I think a lot of people think that they're not going to get sick. Mm-hmm. I guess why are warmer temperatures not as much of a buffer as we would like it to be?
Well, there's some viruses that do circulate primarily in the winter because the temperature and the humidity favor their survival. And that's why we see influenza, non-COVID strains of coronavirus, and RSV primarily in the winter. And then when it gets warmer and the humidity changes, they just sort of die out. They don't survive as long, and so we don't see much of them during the summer. But then we get the summer viruses, and a lot of those have an envelope on them that help them survive during the summer, and then they circulate primarily during that season.
I feel like this is also the time of year. I mean, we had a red flag warning. The winds are kicking up. You have pollen, you know, covering your cars. It's kind of hard to tell. Is it allergies, or am I coming down with something?
That can be very difficult because upper respiratory infections and allergies both can result in runny nose, coughing, and sneezing. But one of the ways that you can differentiate those is fever. Really, you don't get a fever with allergies. So if you've got those kind of symptoms and a fever, that's going to be due to an infection, mm-hmm. not allergies.
And even though allergies aren't contagious, of course, they can really, like, mimic being sick, as you just laid out. They can really affect your energy. Is there anything that you can do? I think, is it basically just taking an antihistamine to kind of help alleviate that?
Yes, I think the intranasal nasal sprays, those work pretty well as taking the antihistamine, especially the non-sedating kind, are useful. Staying indoors, having an air filter can help you avoid allergies. And then really, if you're going to be outdoors, to avoid more the late afternoon, since that's when pollen really peaks.
The biggest headline at the moment is hantavirus. What do we really need to know about this disease? I know that it does exist in California. The headlines, of course, are connected to that cruise outbreak. It does have some ties to California. CDPH is monitoring. But there's also been a confirmed death in Colorado. I mean, how much do people need to worry about this?
Yeah, so there's almost 40 strains of hantavirus, but the only strain that's transmitted person to person is the Andes strain, and that's the one that we've seen on this cruise ship. So there is no risk of getting hantavirus from contact with another person unless you are on that cruise ship or you have direct contact with somebody who is on that cruise ship who is symptomatic. It's not transmitted in the pre-symptomatic phase, as far as we're aware. So the risk is extremely low, and we really don't expect a long transmission chain. But the incubation period is between 1 to 6 weeks, and so we're going to have it's a really long incubation period. Because of that, the patients who were exposed, the people who were exposed, they're going to be monitored into June. And so we really won't know until late June or early July when we're able to say that this is all over.
There are strains here. How does someone get hantavirus in California?
Yeah, so in California, we have a different strain of hantavirus, the Sinombre virus, and that's primarily carried by the deer mouse. The deer mouse in California is primarily above 2,900 feet, and almost all cases are at altitude in the eastern Sierra. And the most common story that we hear with people who get exposed is there might be a cabin that people only use in the summer. Maybe there's rodent infestation over the winter. People come in to the cabin and then they clean it out. They start sweeping up. That can aerosolize some of the mouse excretions. And then they breathe them in, and that's how they can get them.
What symptoms should they be looking out for? I mean, an incubation period of 6 weeks, it can be kind of hard to trace back to that time you were cleaning your cabin out.
Yeah. So really at the beginning, the symptoms are very similar to a lot of other infections. So fever, muscle aches, things like that, maybe some respiratory symptoms, cough and runny nose. So it's very, very difficult to really differentiate that from other common infections. But what happens is a few days in, a very rapidly progressive severe pneumonia occurs, shortness of breath, severe shortness of breath, and these patients are really sick. So they end up in the ICU, usually on a ventilator, and they really get so severely sick that some of them have to be on like a heart-lung bypass machine to be able to get enough oxygen in. And that's when doctors really start suspecting it as those really severely ill patients.
Is there a test for it?
Oh, yeah, there's a test for it. By the time they're sick, we can send off an antibody test because they've usually had an immune response to it. And there's also PCR tests for it. So we can diagnose that.
Given that this is the unofficial start of summer, we're heading into the holiday weekends. One way that people spend time with each other, I just got back from one, is a cruise. And so I don't think hantavirus is the overarching concern, but you got a lot of people in a very contained space. Getting sick is not uncommon. I guess, why are these environments just so susceptible? Is it just because you got a lot of people in a small space?
That's exactly it. So you've got a really densely populated space. You really can't get away from people if you want to, unless you just stay in your cabin the whole time. You know, studies show that people on cruises have twice as many human-to-human contacts, compared to their daily lives. And so that's going to increase your risk of transmission from those events. Plus, you're in the same environment. So any kind of environmental contaminant, such as norovirus, for example, that's just going to spread through the crew and the passengers.
Is that like food poisoning?
Yeah, so norovirus is causes vomiting and diarrhea. It's known as winter vomiting disease, meaning it's more common in the winter and does cause a lot of vomiting. But the cruise ships, because the cruise ships are so concentrated and it is transmitted by food items that can be contaminated. And we all know about buffets where it's really easy to contaminate a buffet. So you often get these cruise ships that have outbreaks. That's a relatively common outbreak on a cruise ship.
If you are a bit of a worrier, is it just as simple as washing your hands, carrying hand sanitizer?
So washing your hands is really the primary way to prevent infection on a cruise ship. Hand sanitizer is good, but it's not as effective as actual hand washing with soap and water for norovirus. So people who are really worried about it, really I would make the effort to use a sink and use soap and water. And I know that's less convenient. It's so much easier to carry around a small container of hand sanitizer and just use that all the time.
Yeah. So I guess the scrubbing helps a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. Physically removing the virus.
Another headline is over in Africa. There is a rare Ebola strain spreading. There's no vaccine. I mean, obviously that is far away, but we have learned from COVID that an ocean doesn't necessarily stop the spread of infection. How concerned should we be?
I think it's a real concern. If you consider where this outbreak is occurring, it's a really remote area. It's hard to reach. They don't have sophisticated health services. The diagnostics are difficult to arrange. And the public health infrastructure isn't very good. It's a conflict zone in a lot of these areas. And so really, you can have a lot of transmission. And by the time this Ebola outbreak was discovered, it had really spread quite far.
Why is Ebola so severe?
Yeah, so the thing is, Ebola is one of those viruses that's part of the hemorrhagic fever viruses. And so it can cause the illness that can start off with fever and vomiting and diarrhea, and then it can cause the bleeding. And so the bleeding really can lead to severe problems. Mostly that's gastrointestinal bleeding, but it can also lead to organ failure. So these patients often require respiratory support, such as being on a ventilator. The electrolytes can be way off. The kidneys may fail, the liver may fail. And so it affects so many different systems that's why these patients need a lot of intensive care.
Is it very contagious?
Well, it can be contagious, not before patients are symptomatic, but after they become symptomatic, their blood and body fluids have extraordinarily high concentrations of virus. And that's why it's so important to have appropriate PPE, which is another challenge in these areas because they just don't have adequate PPE. And a lot of that's related to U.S. funding cuts from the CDC and from USAID.
That's interesting that if you don't have symptoms yet, you're not contagious. I mean, I've talked to you a bunch about about infectious diseases, and it seems like, you know, with the flu or even with COVID, you can be contagious even if you don't have symptoms.
Yeah, those are two good examples that a day or two before you have symptoms, you can be contagious, and that's primarily through the respiratory route. With Ebola, it seems to get into the bloodstream, and you don't get those really high concentrations of the virus until people are symptomatic, and that's why it's not contagious before they're symptomatic.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg about avoiding summer sicknesses. As the weather heats up, we tend to, you know, let our guards down, have fun, but there are plenty of bugs still circulating around. So speaking of circulating, when looking at the wastewater in both the Bay Area and in Stockton, there have been recent reports of parvovirus. What is this virus?
Yeah, so parvovirus is a common childhood disease, but anybody can get it at any age, and it does cause fever, and then it causes a distinctive rash, a slapped cheek appearance is what it looks like in young children, where their cheeks look very red. And it usually is very mild. It resolves pretty quickly without problems. But it can be a problem for those who are immunocompromised, for anybody with any kind of blood cell problem, such as sickle cell. And also during pregnancy, it can affect the fetus.
How do you avoid it?
You know, it's very difficult to avoid because by the time people are most symptomatic with the rash, they're no longer contagious. And so it's very difficult to avoid. And virtually everybody does get infected at some point in their life.
What kind of treatment is there if you do have it?
You know, for those who are immunocompromised that have weakened immune systems or who have prolonged infection, we can give immunoglobulin treatment to hasten recovery. But there is no specific antiviral therapy. And I just want to also mention, because this is often a point of confusion, parvovirus can cause problems in dogs and humans. Those are two completely different parvoviruses. So dog parvovirus is, people don't get that, and the dogs don't get human viruses from us.
Yeah, that is important. So many people have dogs as pets. Yeah, this also brings up an important reminder. I mean, by learning about these rates in Stockton and the Bay Area, it's because of monitoring public wastewater. How useful is this tool?
Yeah, I think we first learned how useful it was during COVID when we were able to predict outbreaks in communities that followed the detection in wastewater. And then subsequently, we've learned that with other infectious diseases. So, for example, if you detect polio in the wastewater, you know that that's been imported into a community and there's risk to that community. Same with measles. We might not be seeing measles in a particular area, but if it's detected in the wastewater, we know that there's been somebody who's been infected with measles and they're at risk. And then public health can enhance surveillance and then find those cases.
Yeah, finally, we have talked about this one on Insight about a year ago. It's Valley Fever. At one point, the state was monitoring in infections. What is Valley Fever? Because it predominantly impacts the Central Valley, correct?
Yeah, so Valley Fever is a fungal infection. It can cause pneumonia, but it can also cause prolonged symptoms that can include weight loss also and some other more severe manifestations like meningitis or infection of the bone. And it is primarily in the Southern Central Valley, so Kern County, Fresno, Bakersfield area are kind of hot spots for Coxie, but it can be seen in other counties too, and it's really affected by the weather conditions too.
Is there a time of year when there's an uptick in Valley Fever?
So in a county where you're going to get exceptional rainfall during the winter, that's going to allow the fungus to really increase in concentration. And then in the summer, if you get a dry summer, that allows the spores to be more available. And then if it's windy, then that aerosolizes the spores. Once the spores get in the air, that's where people get it. So we know that it was a pretty wet winter this year in Kern and San Luis Obispo counties. So we know that if we get like really dry, windy weather, like we just recently recently had locally, if that occurs there, we would expect an increase in valley fever cases.
What can you do to protect yourself?
Well, there is no vaccine, but you can protect yourself by avoiding these kind of windy, dusty outdoor areas, areas where maybe there's building going on, foundations being built, a lot of digging. There's been outbreaks related to the archaeological digs. So really trying to avoid areas that are going to have the dirt get that increased risk into the air.
Well, Dr. Blomberg, thank you for joining us. You know, we're always talking about things with you that aren't necessarily fun. No one wants to actually experience them, but it is important to know what is going on. So we appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay healthy.
You as well. Dr. Dean Blomberg is a pediatric infectious disease physician at UC Davis Health, and we've been talking about avoiding summer sicknesses. There are a lot of bugs circulating around, as well as allergies. Up next, the most popular countertop in the country is artificial stone, but this engineered material has been linked to a deadly lung disease among a growing number of stone workers. We'll learn about the dire challenges they're facing as the state weighs whether to ban the material in California. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.